And good afternoon again. My name is Dan Hall, and I represent Mr. Collins on this appeal, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may.
All right.
May it please the court, this was a robbery and malicious wounding case with an eyewitness who claimed that he got a ride with the defendant and then was shot by him, but he didn't say that at first. Two issues were granted. One was the sufficiency of the evidence, and one was whether or not the trial court erred by refusing to suppress evidence from a cell phone that was used in the trial based on a Fourth Amendment argument. And one thing that I want to say right at the beginning is that the trial court ruled in this case that the affidavit used to search the cell phone was not adequate. That ruling was never challenged. No crosshair has been assigned to it. And so that's the law of this case. So the sole question for this court to determine on that is whether or not good faith applies. And if good faith doesn't apply, this court looks at the proof beyond a reasonable doubt question of harmless error.
Well, and you know, the exclusionary rule is there to deter police misconduct. Correct. We want to encourage warrants. Warrants are a good thing.
Correct.
Here, the officer didn't get one warrant regarding these cell phones. He got two. He got one authorizing him to seize them when he knew where they were and they were in a fixed location. They'd been removed from the defendant because he had been arrested. And then he got a second warrant to search the contents of the phones. And I understand your argument, but of course, he got that second warrant from a sitting Richmond Circuit Court judge. And so for you to be correct that the officer knew or should have known that he had no business relying on that warrant, we have to also conclude that that he knows more than the Richmond Circuit Court judge, don't we?
Well, we have another Richmond Circuit Court judge who ruled in this case that that was an adequate affidavit.
Well, so I expect judges to disagree from time to time. Okay. I don't know that I expect the police officers to know with 100% certainty what the judges, what at least one judge apparently did not know.
Right, Judge Russell, but I think the problem is that even the Leon case, the good faith exception case, says that there, if it's objectively a bare bones affidavit, it's not objectively reasonable for the officer to rely on that. But I also want to note the fact that the trial court didn't rule that good faith applied because the officer thought that this warrant was good. He ruled that the changing law of searching personal devices applied. And that's sort of like arguing that because, say, the state of North Carolina hasn't sorted out how many taillights your car is supposed to have, that if the police rely on some opinions or Supreme Court North Carolina opinions in citing someone and then searching their car when they find evidence, that that was good faith. There's no changing law in the area of search warrants on cell phones. In 2014, the United States Supreme Court said they are more private than our homes. And so the law on inadequate warrants and inadequate affidavits is right out there for any police officer to know. So in this case, they should have known. They didn't even specify what kind of evidence they were looking for. So even if we get past the fact that the trial court didn't even address that, and we get just to the question of good faith in general, no. Virginia's case law has shown that, for instance, the case that allowed them to go ahead on good faith, even though they didn't specify enough about a home, at least they knew about the criminal wrongdoing and the possession of those drugs. In this case, it's basically an affidavit that says, violent criminals use cell phones because of my training and experience. And the problem is that is objectively unreasonable. Everybody uses cell phones. If I went into a 7-Eleven on a dare and stole a candy bar, you arrested me for shoplifting, could you get a warrant by saying I could have bragged about it on social media? I don't think so. Anybody could have their cell phone seized. And what's noteworthy, the Commonwealth mentioned the idea that it was specific. What they try to argue to save this under good faith is at least they specified different things they were looking for. But what they really specified were just all the parts of the phone. They said, we want to know about the call log. We want to know about any texts. We want to know, and they said that the data in the phone. So the specificity didn't go to evidence of crime. It went to every single part of the phone they wanted to search, which is precisely what's wrong with a facially unreasonable affidavit. It amounts to a general warrant, and it means they can rummage through his phone. And that was not harmless error in this case because it was a jury trial. And I've argued pretty thoroughly in my brief on sufficiency of the evidence, but we've got to remember we have a man who claims he knows the perpetrator but sits there and refuses to identify anyone. Then you have independent witnesses who see someone else. And then you have a perpetrator who can't even place the shooting where, or a victim who can't place the shooting where the police themselves found the physical evidence. So a jury would most likely, when you consider that beyond a reasonable doubt, a jury is wondering, in the city of Richmond especially, which way to go. If you get that social media picture with the pink gun, that's that magic bullet. Juries love to see that a defendant didn't say a lot about the case and didn't address certain things, and they wonder, and then the Commonwealth brings that picture in and shows it, and that makes a profound difference. So this was not harmless error, and the evidence was not sufficient otherwise to convict him of this. But again, it's the police, they went into excruciating detail about the crime that was committed, and no detail in that affidavit whatsoever about what they were looking for. And if this court upholds that affidavit, this court will turn the law of search warrants upside down in the face of the Supreme Court saying that that cell phone is more private than your home. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. The trial court did not err in denying the defendant's motion to suppress. While the warrant affidavit in this case was not sufficiently particularized to support probable cause, it did contain some indicia of probable cause, and therefore the trial court correctly found that the police officer was reasonable to rely on this warrant, which, as the Court has noted, was issued by a sitting circuit court judge and was the second search warrant for this cell phone in this case.
What indicia of probable cause, other than it's his phone and we have reason to believe he did something bad, was there?
Of course, Your Honor. So in this case, and I'll note, this court performed a similar analysis in the Sowers case where the court looks to the facts that are pled in the affidavit, in the warrant affidavit in its entirety. And in this case, we have a shooting that evinces personal animus. We have in that affidavit that the victim knew his shooter, knew him personally. The victim was shot in broad daylight 5 times, including 1 time where the defendant, or the suspect, lifted the victim off the ground, shot him again, and left him on the ground. The facts of this crime give rise to a reasonable inference that this was an intentional or purposeful, and also a shooting that was motivated by personal animus. I mean, in light of the relationship between the parties and the facts of this crime, which suggest personal animus, a police officer would be reasonable to believe that evidence of motive would have been found on this cell phone. And that's exactly what the police officer claimed he was looking for when he says he's looking for how the crime occurred and who was involved. They're seeking motive evidence and also whether there were additional defendants involved in this shooting. So there is some indicia of probable cause in this affidavit. And I would note that, again, we're not looking at probable cause. We're not looking at a substantial basis to find probable cause. We're looking at whether that police officer was entirely unreasonable in relying on this affidavit, and that is a low burden compared to the two other tests that I have suggested for the court. It's significant that in that Sowers case, this court did move to a good faith exception and found there that while there was an overly broad declaration in the affidavit that this evidence might be found in this person's home, there was sufficient facts there for the police officer to have relied on this affidavit in good faith, especially considering in this case that a sitting circuit court judge signed this warrant, which normally police officers aren't required to look behind even a magistrate's determination of probable cause, much less circuit court judges. And also this was the second warrant affidavit sought for the phone in this case, one to obtain the phone and a second separate warrant for its contents. I think it's also significant that while Riley says you need a search warrant, it doesn't say what has to be in it. And of course, police officers do, or detectives in this case, are used to submitting these affidavits, et cetera. But it is an evolving area of the law, even if the law is well settled that you need one. The officer knew that. He got one. The question is what had to be in it. And certainly this officer acting in good faith could have reasonably believed, especially given the procedural posture there, that this search warrant was good. and the search was obtained, or the search was conducted within the parameters of that search warrant. Again, it's significant. This is not a bare bones affidavit. We have that they were looking for evidence of how the crime occurred and who was involved, which is what links. And we have the defendant who is the supposed shooter. There are plenty of facts to support the detective's inference there. And that's why he's a suspect in this case. And we're looking at his phone in particular. This phone was found on him. It was recovered 5 days after the shooting in this case. It's not an issue of lacking a facial nexus to the crime that occurred, as in some of the court's other cases, like Sowers and Answalda, which both, again, went on to rely on this good faith analysis. And I would submit that the trial court was correct in finding that this was an overly broad statement. It's only debatable, but that's what the trial court found in this case, and moving on to the good faith analysis correctly, found that the Detective Godwin did have that bare level. There was some indicia of probable cause in that affidavit. And even if the trial court erred in that respect, the Commonwealth submits that any error was harmless. The only evidence recovered from that cell phone was a photograph of a gun and a photograph of the defendant. That photograph, of course, the defendant contends at trial is a cover of his rap album. It's not actually a photograph of a gun, et cetera. But still, that photograph did not tip the balance in this case.
It's important enough for the Commonwealth to want to introduce it, though.
Certainly, Your Honor, but that would be the case with every harmless error analysis that this court has to conduct. If it didn't come in at trial, otherwise we wouldn't be here. But we do have in this case a victim and a defendant who knew each other, who both admit they know each other. So the victim identifies his shooter not once, but twice. And that's on Appendix 211 and 275. Although in the video to the first responder, the jury sees, he doesn't identify the defendant there, but he does identify the defendant as T while he's at the scene before being transported to the hospital, and again also following that double-blind police lineup. And we don't have the defendant disputing that they knew each other. What we do have is the defendant's ever-changing version of events in this case, where first he wasn't downtown at all, and then maybe he was downtown, but he wasn't involved in the shooting of this guy, and then, oh, well, I don't know who the guy was, and suddenly at trial, he knows who the guy was, he was dealing drugs to him, and everything matches up fairly closely until we get right to the moment of the shooting, when a third party appears and shoots the victim, notably only once. The undisputed medical testimony is the victim was shot, four shots at least hit home. We have an independent witness who heard five shots. The defendant's statement that he was 2 to 3 feet behind the victim and only heard one shot in this case is belied by the remainder of the evidence. So again, we have that victim's testimony. We have an independent witness. We have the defendant not being credible. It's also noteworthy that the defendant is a five-time convicted felon, three misdemeanors, I believe, involving moral turpitude. I recognize the victim also was convicted of lying to the police at some point. The defendant brings that up, but I think the court can still consider the defendant's character for truthfulness in light of those felony convictions. And all of that evidence was sufficient that the jury could and would have found the defendant guilty of these crimes, regardless of a photograph of a weapon that was not produced at trial. And again, without the weapon being produced at trial, couldn't have been linked specifically to the shooting in this case. So we would submit that that was harmless beyond reasonable doubt here, which is the standard for Fourth Amendment violation. Briefly to touch on the second assignment of error regarding sufficiency to show identity, similar reasons support the Commonwealth's position that the evidence was sufficient to show identity in this case. Again, moving to a better standard for the Commonwealth, I guess, as the appellee there, or a more stringent standard for the defendant, the jury had an opportunity to judge the credibility of these witnesses. We have the defendant taking the stand, saying it didn't happen this way, the victim saying that it did. The jury was entitled to look at both of their testimonies, compare the consistencies, compare that to the other independent witnesses who testified, and find that the victim in this case was credible and the identification of the defendant was truthful in this case. So certainly when we're looking at it from a sufficiency standpoint, the evidence was sufficient to show that the defendant was the perpetrator of this crime. I would be happy to address any questions that the court has. Otherwise, I'd ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mr. Hall?
Just some things to remind this honorable court about. Number one, it is explicitly a bare-bones affidavit by the ruling of the trial court, so we know that that's not even a question. Number two, and number three, really, the Leon case talks about good faith. The fact that the police got a warrant in the first place and then got another warrant shows that the police are trying to do what they're supposed to do. You cannot deny that. I don't deny that. But the Leon case talks about completely facially unreasonable warrants, and the police are still held to that standard, and this Commonwealth still follows that standard, obviously. And so that goes to the question of the judge. This was a circuit court judge, and I give him all due deference, but he's a detached and neutral magistrate. That's the law of search warrants, and Leon still says that a facially invalid warrant, an unreasonable warrant, the police cannot rely on that. And so we're still at the question of how unreasonable it is to just search the phone because the person's arrested for a violent crime. Also, I think you have to look at the fact that the victim refused to say who it was at first and then later said he knew exactly who it is. So what exactly is it that the police needed to find from that phone? The argument that the evidence was sufficient in this case closes in on the argument of what were they possibly looking for on his phone? And why do they need to look for something on his phone? And so this affidavit was, it just says, I'm trained and criminals use these phones so I can search it. And it was not sufficient. It's facially unreasonable and the court should reverse the trial court and grant the suppression remedy. And it was not harmless because of the fact that of the vagueness in this case, the contradictory evidence offered by the victim compared to the Commonwealth's own testimony, and that picture, as Judge Russell, you noted, the Commonwealth really wanted to get that in, and the Commonwealth acknowledges to make their case, and so this should be reversed and dismissed. Thank you.
We'll come down and greet counsel.